Mr. Dupree noted, as the class was getting underway, this is the second day of Plato. So here we are in day number two. Very astute observation on his part, and it's very common for philosophy professors, when they're introducing Plato, to do so by rolling a chair into the middle of the room. This is the way I was taught Plato. It's good enough for me, it's good enough for you, Josiah. So this is the way we're going to do it. So I've already given away the chief point that I'm trying to make. So I'm going to have to back up a little bit. I'm going to call on Ms. McFarlane. And I have placed in the middle of the room here an object. And if I were to ask you, what is the object? What would you call it? You would call it a chair. Excellent. Now, I'm suspicious the only reason you gave that correct answer is because I myself said I was rolling a chair into the middle of the room. That's what tipped you off. Correct? No? You might have said that any other, even if I hadn't told you? And Ms. McFarlane, you were also sitting on a certain object. Well, not right now, but you were a moment ago, and maybe by the end of the class you will be again. And what would you call that object? A chair. So now you'll notice that Laura has used one word and applied it to two different objects. Y'all catch that? This is kind of deep, but hang on. Now, Laura, are those two objects to which you applied the word chair exactly the same? All right. They're not. They're different. So why is it that you will use one word to describe two objects which are not the same?
They're similar. They're used for the same thing.
Okay, they're similar. That's good. Important philosophical idea. They're similar. And you refer to their use. Those are two different ways by which you have put these two objects in the same class. You said in one way they're similar, but they're also, maybe you mean the same thing by that, but you also say they have the same use. What is the use that you have in mind?
You sit upon it.
Have you ever sat upon anything that you would not call a chair? For example, a couch. So just sitting is not what makes it a chair. Because you could sit on the floor. You could sit on, I'm guessing, something you might call a stool, a couch, sofa, divan, right? All kinds of objects in this world that you might sit on that are not what you would call a chair. So what is it about these two objects that has caused you to call them chairs? One of the things might not be. It's a one-person thing.
The couch you sit on it, but it has...
All right.
Wow.
So, can you imagine sitting on a one-person thing that still might not be a chair? Would any one-person thing you sit on be called a chair?
Well, I guess a stool would be the same.
A stool, maybe. Yeah. Let me ask you this. In terms of their similarity, we've been talking about function, but I'm talking about use, but in terms of their similarity, are there other ways in which they are similar besides just the use you would make of them?
They look the same.
They look same, okay. That object you have over there, how many legs does it have on it? No, the one behind you.
Four.
And how many legs does this one have? That's right. So it doesn't even have legs, does it? It makes maybe the center post, you could call it. And then it's got these. Does this one that you've got over there have wheels? Does this one have wheels? Does that one have cushy? Does this one have cushy? Does that one rock? Does this one rock? Does that one swivel? Does this one swivel? Looks to me like they're different in a lot of different respects here, right? Would you agree with me? And yet you still insist on calling both of them by the word chair, correct?
The basic shape.
I don't know. This one has arms. That one doesn't have arms. You're talking about just the basic right angle. That's a lot of things that have right angles in life. And maybe some of them you could sit on. Thank you, Mr. Cheeler. And, you know, if you'd like to try sitting on that, we'd like to see how that goes.
Do you see, ladies?
Thank you, Laura. Now, this little exercise that I've gone through with Laura may seem somewhat silly, but it does raise this philosophical question, and this is a somewhat serious question in the midst of a somewhat trivial conversation, and that is that all of us have this ability to take individual objects and put those objects into classes, into categories of things, right? And we do it all the time. We don't think of it as some great, you know, work of genius on our part. We just do it. So Laura looked at these two objects and called them chair. And the question that comes up in a discussion of Plato and in philosophy generally is, by what means did we do that? How did we go through the mental gymnastic of taking two quite different objects and nevertheless calling them by the same term? There's one answer, which has generally been the answer given down through the history of empiricism. There's another answer that's been given down through the history of rationalism. Plato is a rationalist, and his answer is that both of these objects can be called chairs because they both, says Plato, participate in... Yes. You want to say that a little louder?
Chairness.
Chairness. There is a chairness-ness about these two objects. Now, what do you suppose, Krista, is the intended meaning of a statement like that? That they both participate in chairness, or as I said it, there's a chairness-ness about them. What are we saying there?
Just avoiding a definition by using chair in a different form.
Well,
chairness.
What do you mean by what do we mean by chairness? Does that provoke any idea in your head to say this object and that object?
The essence of a chair.
The essence of a chair. Right. Has anybody ever experienced the essence of chair? Sydney? Never?
Chair.
The essence of chair. C-H-A-I-R. Sydney, ever experienced that? What would that be? What would the essence of chair be? What would it be? Can you imagine it? Can you imagine the essence of chair? You cannot imagine it? Oh, please. Can somebody imagine the essence? Wake up over there. Can you imagine the essence of a chair, Jacob? Okay, well, yeah, you know that's a chair. You know that's a chair. You know, you see objects in this world, you say they're chairs. And so there must be something in your head, which is the kind of the essential idea by which you call these things chairs and you don't call them, thumbtacks. I mean, you have, and what is that essential chair that you have in your head there?
Probably just whatever kind of chair I've seen the most often, and then I compare that to other objects that I see.
You are talking just like Aristotle. There's not a good Platonist in the room. Aristotle would say that. Save that answer when we come back to this in a couple of weeks. That'll be a good answer. All right. I thought somebody'd come through for me here. But you know, you think when you think the essence of chair, you think like the ultimate, eternal, perfect chair. It's the essential chair. It cannot change throughout eternity. It is the absolute chair. Is that what you were thinking? No. Now it is. Was that what you were thinking? You, I should have given you a chance. You're the one that came up with the word here.
That's right.
But well, this is Plato's idea. So Plato makes a distinction in his philosophy, and this is probably the single best known, most famous, most important distinction that you have. This is the heart of Platonism. And he makes this distinction between what he calls the ideal and the receptacle. I misspelled it. Receptacle. So Plato is an idealist because he believes there is an ideal world. And that ideal world doesn't change. It is eternal. It is fixed. It has in it only essence. We are going to use the word idealist repeatedly throughout the rest of the year, so I want you to get it in your heads right now. An idealist, of whom Plato is the most famous, is someone who believes that there are great eternal ideals, either one or more. We don't experience them directly, but they must be there. Ideals. Chairness would be an ideal. Plato is also called a realist. Now, ordinarily, Trevor, when we hear the word realist and when we hear the word idealist, we think of two different kinds of people. You ever heard those words used? Oh, Sarah here, she's a realist. But Sydney, wow, is she an idealist? You ever heard the terms used that way? So what would be the difference? If I said that Sarah is a realist, but Sydney is an idealist, what distinction would I presumably be making? Not that I'm actually saying that about either of them, but what distinction would I be making were I to say that?
Well, when I hear people describe like that, to me I always get the image that I don't know if you call it realist, but when I hear someone called a realist, they're more down to earth and they just think, I don't know, practically and stuff.
Practically.
Idealists are kind of up in the clouds.
Head in the clouds. Okay. Yeah. That's good. Very good answer. Y'all kind of follow that. Isn't that a pretty common way of distinguishing those? Somebody's realistic, somebody's idealistic. We usually think of them as two different kinds of people. Do not think that way in philosophy. Okay? They are the same thing. Plato is an idealist, and Plato is a realist. We don't mean it in the popular sense, we mean it in the philosophical sense. Make that distinction, hang on to it from this day on in your philosophical thought. What we mean by this is, as in the case of Plato, there are ideals and they are real. For Plato, chairness is not just an idea, as Matthew was describing. Matthew gave the classic formulation of nominalism. Chair is just a word, a name, a nomon, nominalism. I look at things, I notice they're similar, I call them by the same name. That is not Plato. Okay? Plato says, I look at things and I call them chair because somewhere in my head is a memory, a picture, an idea of the perfect, essential, archetypal, eternal, unchanging chair. to wit, chairness. And I have it there. And as soon as I encounter an object that resembles that idea in my head, I use the word that describes the similarity to that which is in my head. Okay? Did you have your hand up, Jake? You didn't. Okay, Matthew. And then...
How do we get that in our head?
Excellent question. Where does it come from? That is a major conversation we need to have. It's the whole question of Plato's epistemology. Matthew, let me give you a very short answer now, with the promise that we will come back and talk about it in greater detail before we're done with Plato, okay? The short answer is, we remember it. We remember it. That somehow or other, you at some time experienced that eternal chair and you have a recollection of it.
Okay. So there's a perfect chair out there?
Yes, it's real. That chair is real and you have experienced it. Not in this world, some prior existence, but you recall it. However dimly, it's there. Okay. That's called his theory of recollection. Like I say, that's a very inadequate answer, but I want to come back to that. We'll talk about that, you know, more. Go ahead.
So, is he like one of those people that believes that you have multiple existences?
Yes, he does, but he does have a theory of reincarnation. But that's not central to what we're talking about right now. That's almost, he got that from the Pythagoreans, who also had an idea of reincarnation. But this is not quite the same thing. Okay, it's a good connection, good thought, but it's not quite the same thing. But yes, he did in fact affirm that. Yeah. Sydney, you had your, that was it.
So was this ideal essence just for objects, or was it for animals and people too? Did they have an ideal person?
It's, that's a good question, and it's a complicated question. And I don't know, I think scholars in Plato differ as to their answers of, is there a perfect aardvark? Is there a perfect orangutan? You know, certainly those are not points that Plato addressed directly. Presumably, yes. Presumably, any object in this world that we can say it is a something, we can call it, there's going to be an eternal expression of that in the ideal world. But some would doubt that. And then you'd have the question, well, what about a unicorn? You know. Well, most of us have never experienced directly a unicorn. You ever woke up, looked out in your backyard, Kayla, and saw a unicorn? Maybe in your little girl imagination once, years and years ago, you imagined a unicorn. But, you know, most of us... But we have an idea. So is the idea of a unicorn something that we recall because we saw it in the ideal world, or is that something we just cooked up out of our imagination? Well, that's a debate that scholars in Plato can't really agree on. And it's part of that whole problem. Very importantly, though, for Plato, there would be the perfect man or the perfect human. You know, perfect man or woman, I guess. That becomes very important. Yeah, there he is. Whoa, he's here! Because that ideal world is real. It's really out there. And so it's not like, well, this is something we invented out of our imagination. It's something that we actually experienced, and we all experienced the same thing. So that's part of why he's not a relativist for that very reason. It's very good. Transcendent. It's not part of this world. It's otherworldly. That's what distinguishes it from this receptacle world, which is the world in which we live. All right. We live in the world of imperfect copies. So there's jillions of chairs in this world. None of them are a perfect replica of that eternal ideal chair. But there are many imperfect copies, and when we see a copy, We recognize it as such and call it by the name chair. Matthew.
Is this kind of tied to his like standard of beauty?
Yes. Like, yeah. Like, excellent.
Like we have the thing in our mind and we compare it.
Yeah. That's right. Excellent. Thank you. So yesterday I showed you two great pieces of art. Remember that? The Mona Lisa and Nicole, the
Betty Sue.
The Betty Sue. And I tried to solicit from you opinions, only one of which was very respectable, namely the opinion of Mr. Fugit, arguing that the Betty Sue was superior to the Mona Lisa. But most of you, if you were actually honest with me, including Mr. Fugit, who's a great actor and can pull the part off well, but even he, down deep inside, knows that the Mona Lisa beats the Betty Sue. And the question is, why do you know that? Why are you all so secure in your opinion that the Mona Lisa is superior in beauty to the Betty Sue? Answer? Go ahead and give the answer, Matthew. You asked the question that would point to the right answer.
Because we have a perfect picture or something in our head, and then we compare whatever the painting said in the question, then determine it's more like that.
Exactly.
I had another question, actually.
Okay, then hold on to that question, because I want to make sure everyone caught this. Okay. I've put this because I don't know how else to picture it, but I want you to imagine not something that is beautiful, you know, but I want you to imagine as best you can beauty. Whatever that is, beauty. I was asking you a minute ago to imagine chairness, and you were having trouble with that. This may be even tougher. I want you to just imagine eternal, essential, perfect beauty. Let's see. Whatever comes to your mind. Well, what Plato is saying is that is what's here. There is the perfect and eternal, not just beautiful thing, but beauty as such. And you have it in your mind, and therefore as you go through this world, you can routinely and easily, many times, distinguish that which has greater beauty from that which has less beauty. You distinguish Mona Lisa from Betty Sue. You distinguish all through life, beautiful this, beautiful that, not because you're just making a private judgment about it, but because lingering in your mind is that essential, eternal notion of beauty. And it's there. And strangely enough, most of us agree most of the time on what is beautiful and what isn't. Now, sometimes we differ on fine points, you know. Is the Last Supper more beautiful than the Mona Lisa? Well, we can have that conversation. But listen to me, the very fact that we can have the conversation means that we have something in us telling us that there is that which is beautiful ultimately. Otherwise, the conversation would be meaningless. You see, even if we differ, it proves the point that Plato's making. We've got some idea of that which is eternally an expression of beauty. Kind of tracking with that, you see what's going on here? Matthew, you have it.
Well, you kind of already answered it. I was going to ask how does he explain that we think some people are better looking than other people if we all have the same standard
yeah.
of beauty?
Yeah. Kind of. Excellent. And again, this kind of goes back to your prior question, where does it come from? And again, I'm going to hold off on giving you an adequate answer by just giving a real short answer. Some of us remember it better than others. Okay, some of us are more philosophical than others of us. And Plato, of course, in his Republic, argues that those people who do this the best should be the ones that rule, right? The philosopher kings. But he says we all can do it. We all have it somewhere in our heads. Spencer.
So, is that chair is still real though, right?
That's a real chair.
It's just not the perfect one.
It's not the perfect chair. It's closer. I mean, to be honest with you, I sit on this chair. It's not bad. Leans back. I could almost doze off here, you know? Nice. I sit in that thing you call a chair. It's hard, you're bolt upright, you know, you have to, there's no relaxing to it.
Yeah.
And so, if you were to ask me, which of these two objects more closely conforms to chairness, my opinion would be it's this one. Somebody may differ, but again, the very fact that we have the conversation proves that we all share some notion of what the perfect chair would be, right? Yeah.
If the world of forms is considered somewhere in heaven or something, does Plato believe that when people die, they'll get to go there?
Yes.
Okay.
Good question, and be careful about calling it heaven, because that brings too much Christian spin to this. He simply calls it the world of the ideal. But he does believe, and this is part of why Socrates is so kind of confident and relaxed as he anticipates his death, you know, is that he believes as he dies, he's going to be going to that place, and that that will be the place of the experience of ultimate beauty and all of these great things, you know. So he's okay with that. Yeah.
Does he believe the wicked get to go there too? If it's
no, not necessarily. He does believe in virtue. He does believe in an afterlife. He does believe that there is justice. He does believe that justice is part of that eternal circumstance of reality, and that people can live contrary to that justice, and that they will experience negative effects as a result of that. He never works out a kind of robust doctrine of hell, such again as we would find in the Christian faith, but he certainly does work out an idea of bad effects following from a bad life because of his very keen sense of justice. Right? Josiah.
You said that some people are better at remembering that.
Yes. Right.
Is it possible in Plato's mind that people can be taught how to remember?
Yes. Right. We're going to talk about Plato's theory of recollection later, and Josiah's question is good, though. There's one dialogue that's famous in Plato called the Meno dialogue, M-E-N-O, Meno. Anybody ever read it or know anything about it? Are you familiar, anybody, with the Meno? It's if we had more time, we'd read it in here just to kind of illustrate the point. But in the Meno dialogue, Josiah, Socrates, the hero of this little kind of dialogue, takes a slave boy, uneducated, you know, rude, in the sense that he's not sophisticated, and by a series of questions, just by asking questions, gets this slave boy to show that he actually knows the Pythagorean theorem. Not by telling it to him, not by teaching it to him, but just by walking him through the logic of the thing, you know. And the point he makes is, do you see, I didn't teach the kid the Pythagorean theorem. He already knew it. I just drew it out of him. That's the basis of what's called sometimes Socratic teaching. We do a little of that here at the Oaks. We try to get you, sometimes it's harder than at other times, to be honest with you, to actually say the right answer so that I'm not just sitting up here like a talking head, you know, shoveling out data. It's much better if you learn Socratically. You find out you know more than you thought. Now, I don't know. You know, I mean, you'll have to surmise that. I was trying to get you to talk about an ideal chair, and I was not coming up with anything very good. So, but I think you know the idea, don't you? That there's stuff in there, and a well-crafted question may help you pull it out. And that's what Socratic teaching is, and that's what Plato was the master of, and that's what Socrates was really famous for, was Socratic teaching. All right, good questions. Now, in terms of what we've studied so far, Plato is trying to tip his hat to the two philosophical traditions that have been coming down to him. So, Nicole, your most famous Ionian was?
Heraclitus,
thank you. You've almost got me there. And the most famous Italian was, Ben?
Parmenides.
Okay, so you got the Ionian Heraclitus, you've got the Italian Parmenides. And now I'm going to say to you that the ideal world, celebrates one of those and the receptacle world celebrates the other. Which is which? Sarah, for $100? No, I take it back. Which is which? Who is celebrated, which tradition at the ideal level and which tradition at the receptacle level?
Are the Italians the ideal?
That's what I think. Let's see, can I remember that? Nicole, which one was which again?
Parmenides.
Who's who? Just use the names. Parmenides, okay. Heracles.
Parmenides would be ideal.
Okay.
And Heracles would be.
So do you see, Plato is trying to synthesize these two traditions, right? Talked about that yesterday. He wants to tip his hat to both. He wants to acknowledge on the one hand the contribution from Parmenides and also allow for a place for Heraclitus. How does he do it? He has two worlds. The world of Parmenides is the world of being. Whatever is, is. See, perfect, eternal, unchanging being. Perfect chair, perfect beauty, perfect man, perfect virtue, perfect goodness, perfect everything. That's Parmenides' world. It doesn't change. Whatever is, is. But Plato realizes that we got to do something with this world of change, and so he just has a separate world. He calls it the world of the copy, or the receptacle world. Now, the reason it's called receptacle, I'm going to hold off until we talk about his creation myth, and then I'll come back and deal with that briefly later. So just allow right now that that's the word we use, the ideal and the receptacle. This is the world we're living in. It's a world of change, copies, imperfections. And these two worlds are in a tension with each other. There is, in other words, between them, a dualism. In the human makeup, your soul is from which world, Josiah? Your soul is from? The soul comes from the ideal world. He has an argument for the immortality of the soul. See, it's always there. But the body comes from which world, Kayla? This is a fairly easy question. I've got a follow-up question.
It comes from the receptacle.
The receptacle. And what is it about the body that makes it reflect the receptacle as opposed to the soul, which he said reflects the ideal? What is it about the body that makes it more receptacle?
It's not perfect and it's always changing.
It's always changing. That's right. When I look at the changing part of me, I see it's the body. It's getting older and wrinkled, and arthritis, dementia, you know, all of those good things. Yes?
So what do you mean when you say Parmenides was the ideal and Heraclitus was the receptacle?
Yeah. Okay, all I'm saying is remember these two guys, Parmenides, whatever is, is. Mm-hmm. In other words, he's the champion of a world that does not change.
Oh.
So this is Plato acknowledging Parmenides.
So Parmenides doesn't think the receptacle world is...
He doesn't even think it exists.
Okay.
Remember, all else is illusion.
Okay.
For Heraclitus, the only thing that does exist is the illusory world of change, right?
Okay.
Do y'all follow that? This is Plato trying to synthesize these two traditions. He realizes both these guys have something to say, and so he wants to find a place for both of them in his philosophy. But between the two, who gets more emphasis? Plato synthesizes them. But who gets more emphasis in Plato's philosophy? If I could set it up this way, you'd say, you know, in the great scheme of things, he's two-thirds one and one-third the other, let's just say arbitrarily. Well, who gets most of the emphasis here?
Parmenides.
Absolutely. So Plato comes more in the tradition of rationalism, not so much empiricism. When we get to Aristotle, we find just the opposite. Aristotle will be mostly, you know, empirical, mostly the Heraclitus piece, less the Parmenides piece. That's why these two kind of represent another philosophical conflict, just as Parmenides and Heraclitus did. Does that make sense? You following that? What's going on here? Yeah.
So was Plato consciously trying to synthesize them, or did it kind of just...
No, it was conscious. You read his... He writes about both of them, and it's pretty clear he's got them in mind as he's working this out. Yeah, and others. I mean, he likes Pythagoras. You know, he likes all these pre-Socratics. But as you begin to see him incorporating their thought, it's pretty clear what he's attempting to do. All right, what are some of the things that we find in the ideal world? What is Ashkir? Well, I've mentioned two of them. Beauty is there. Chairness is there. Some other ideas that... And he really uses these just to prove his point. He would say, for example, that your idea of a perfect circle is part of your experience of the ideal world. For example, Kaylee, have you ever experienced in your life a perfect circle?
No.
You know what a circle is. Is that a perfect circle?
No.
Would you agree with me that it's not bad? I've drawn this object over here. Would you call that a circle?
No.
Would you call that a circle?
Yes.
Yeah. You've never experienced a perfect circle in your life, but you can distinguish between two objects on the board that are at least somewhat similar and say one is a circle and one isn't, right? You can do that. In other words, you've got a standard in your mind by which you go through life and evaluate its experiences. At this point, the experience is one of circleness, right? And yet you've never seen a perfect circle. In fact, it would be impossible to experience a perfect circle, because how wide is the line that forms the perimeter of a perfect circle? How wide is it? Trevor, how wide is the line that forms the perimeter of a perfect circle? It is what? Geometrically speaking, it is?
I would say it's probably as small as it could possibly be, so almost nothing.
Okay, that's right. Not almost nothing, it is infinitely small. It's like a mathematical point. In fact, a circle is defined as an infinite number of points equidistant from a center point, right? Something like that. And a point has no dimension. A perfect circle has no breadth in the line that forms it. That's what makes it perfect. But you all have it in your head, don't you? You've all got an idea. Kaylee can immediately make distinctions, and yet both of these are miserable as compared to a perfect circle. You see. Outrageously off the mark compared to a perfect circle, and yet one is still better than the other. And we do that all the time, don't we? So that's the kind of thing he would say. Perfect triangle, equilateral triangle. Something you have in your mind. It's part of the ideal. Yeah.
Well, not to get too mathematical.
Uh-huh.
In the three-dimensional world, this would be spheres, right?
Okay, and if you wanted to make a perfect sphere, yeah, you could.
Well,
do that.
But the world, I mean, in this room right now, there's an infinite number of mathematical points.
Yes.
In the three-dimensional area.
Yes.
Meaning there's an infinite number of spheres in this room.
Sure, right.
So what would you say about that?
The point is that any of these that we imagine in this room can only be called sphere or circle or any name we apply to them because they resemble something that is perfect. Now you're talking about maybe different dimensions. One is small, one is large, you know, that. But he says in the ideal world, dimension in that sense, like measurement, like 3 feet or something, doesn't apply. This is a world of perfection. And as soon as I say, well, this is 3 feet wide, I've talked about something that is particular, not something that is universal. You know, so that would be the idea. He says in the ideal world are the whole notion of number, of unity, oneness, duality, two-ness, you know, all of those things are. The idea of sets. Do you ever study sets? Here at the Oaks, that used to be a real rage, you know, in mathematics. Set theory, usually with Venn diagrams and stuff like that. You've done a little bit of that. Plato says that the whole idea of a set, the whole notion that there is a class into which you can put things, is an idea in your mind that comes from the ideal world. The very notion of class as such. The fact that you can put two objects in a class and call them both chairs, that idea of a class itself is ideal, you see. Moral ideas, virtue, piety, justice, beauty, goodness. There are true propositions that are part of the ideal world. If I said Gore was born April 28, 1949, okay, there's a proposition. Now, I'm going to tell you that's my birthday for purposes of making the immediate point, right? It's far enough off. Hopefully, you'll forget by the time it... No, forget it. Yeah. It's always scary, you know? All right. My question is, assuming that's true, Gore is born on a certain date. Is that true today? Is it true today? Jacob, is it true today?
Yes.
Okay. If it's true today, then is the proposition, was it true 1,000 years before it happened? Now, I put it in the past tense. That's what's tripping you up there. So let's just say it more in a kind of timeless sense. The birth of Gore is on that particular day. Would that be true throughout, you know, 1,000 years before it actually happened?
Yes.
And if it's true 1,000 years before, and it'll be true 1,000 years after, could you say, in a sense, it's true eternally? It is true, isn't it? It stands as a great truth. And so this becomes Plato's notion against relativism. There are true propositions. There are true propositions that are true eternally, including the date of Gore's birth, the date of your birth, and an infinite number of other things. He does not create a relativistic universe for us. He creates a universe in which certain things are true, and they are true absolutely. So, what's in the ideal world? I hope you're keeping track of this. I'm kind of throwing them at you. Perfect geometric shapes, number, sets, virtues, propositions, universals of qualities, yellowness, for example, cheerfulness, those would be ideals. Those are universal properties. Universal relations, one thing being above another, and so on, below another, beside another. Those relational properties are universal. Bottom line, where I'm going to stop right now, because time is running out, is that it's your idea of the forms and all of these various expressions that it takes that gives you the capacity to make sense out of the world in which you live. And Plato says you are using this world of the forms constantly to decipher your experience in this world. And if you didn't have those notions of forms, you would be living in worse than the most insane nightmare you can imagine. These are the things that make sense out of your experience of life. Go ahead.
In this world of forms, is there like the ideal war, death, and like all that negative stuff, or is that just a result of the...
I would say Plato would make that derivative. he believes that part of, for example, we have an idea of the good, and derivative from that is an idea of evil. Evil is not an eternal essential idea, but it is the effect of denying the good. And that would be true of a lot of things that we would call kind of negative qualities. Good question. Fair enough. Tomorrow, I want you to read, I'm going to give you the class period to read as much as you can of the, it's called Book 7, you see it there, it's from the Republic, it's the Cave Dialogue, and we'll come back and look at that on Monday. So that's what's coming. Arrivederci.